Welcome to the Internal Medicine for Vet Techs podcast. If you haven't joined us before, we're passionate about all things internal medicine and helping you become the best tech you can be. We'll be discussing interesting internal medicine diseases, how to work closely with pet parents, and how to become the go-to tech in your practice. Now, let's start the show.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Internal Medicine for Vet Techs podcast. Thank you so much for listening and making a commitment to learning. I am one of your hosts. I am Jordan Porter, and I'm joined by the fabulous Yvonne Brandenburg.
Hey.
But we're going to skip over you real quick because we have a guest this week, and our wonderful guest, Miss Kelly. I know right before we recorded this, I asked you how to pronounce your last name because I didn't want to butcher it, but I'm just going to have you introduce yourself, Kelly, and we'll kind of dive into what we're going to be talking about after your introduction.
Yeah, so thank you guys so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here. My name is Kelly Bodwin. I am an LVT. I have had my license since about 2018, spent about 5 years in general practice, and then kind of moved over to specialty practice, started dabbling a little bit in internal medicine, and now I split my time pretty evenly between oncology and my biggest passion, which is radioactive iodine therapy.
Yay!
So crazy. So how long have you been doing the radioactive iodine?
So I've been doing the radioactive iodine for about 2.5 years. I was at my specialty practice kind of just getting my feet wet and getting used to, you know, kind of the different pace and the different level of medicine and practice for about 6 months before I started with the I-131 team.
Nice. And just in case you guys didn't get it, we're gonna talk about I-131 today.
Yeah, because Kelly graciously, I mean, I've been begging y'all to like reach out to me to come on this podcast. But Kelly reached out because she listened to our hyperthyroid episode, and we had mentioned way back then that we really wanted someone to come on and talk about I-131. And so Kelly, being a, you know, more masterful at it than we are, has graciously decided to share some knowledge with everybody. So before we dive into I-131, though, and Kelly kind of educating all of us, we do have a little bit of housekeeping to touch on real quick. We're releasing this just after our March monthly CE. So our next upcoming monthly CE for the Internal Medicine for Vet Techs membership is going to be Saturday, April 13th. We're going to be talking about pain, recognizing and advocating for veterinary patients. And that's Saturday, 2:30 Eastern Standard Time. What is that? 11:30 Pacific Time, Yvonne?
Yeah. Okay. Yep.
I know, I'm getting better at my time zones.
I know. It's just 3 hours, Jordan.
If you are a member, you can join for free. Just use your email address that you use to log into the membership. If you are not a member, you can get the invite by joining the newsletter at internalmedicineforvettechs.com. You can also join the monthly CE. It's $9.99 for non-members.
Yeah, and you can also find it on the website. So if you go to internalmedicineforvettechs.com and you look at CE, you'll be able to find it. So there's a ton of different ways to get there. In this episode, I don't know if this episode is going to be race approved eventually. I think we just have to double check to see if it'll qualify, but we'll let you guys know if it ends up being race approved. So we're excited. We were just talking about I-131 and how close it was to everybody. And I thought, and it was funny because when I lived in the San Francisco Bay Area, there was one, I don't know, an hour, hour and a half, depending on traffic, away from me. And it had been there for so long. I just kind of get so used to it being like a not common thing, but a very readily available thing. And it's funny because right before we started this, I Googled and I was like, oh, there's actually one in Oregon, which is surprising. I don't know how far away it is, but it's not around the corner from me anymore. But yeah, Kelly, I guess we'll throw it over to you and then we'll kind of figure out what else we want to know about it.
Yeah.
Great. Yeah. So I know you guys have a whole episode on feline hyperthyroidism, so I won't really go over any of that. But that's another thing I could talk about for hours. That's my favorite endocrine disease in the cat.
Obviously, I mean, we could always talk about it again in the future.
Yeah, I was going to say, you do some reminders.
So, you know, just briefly talking about hyperthyroidism, it is the most common endocrine disease in senior cats. We don't really see a breed or gender disposition. It kind of affects all senior cats pretty evenly. We do need to remember when we're seeing cats that present with symptoms of hyperthyroidism. The big ones are the weight loss, PUPD. We can see excessive vocalization. And it's always that vocalization that makes your cat sound like they've been smoking like 7 packs of cigarettes their
That's my
entire life.
favorite. It's my
Yeah.
favorite old cat sound. I love
Yep.
it.
It's always at 3 a.m.
Yeah.
So they get, the restlessness, the vocalization. We can see vomiting, diarrhea, weight loss, cardiac murmurs, hypertension. So kind of a bunch of symptoms that present with a lot of different diseases of older cats, right? So when I'm talking to clients and we're seeing these cats and we're recommending any kind of further workup than what their primary vet's already done, I do always remind clients that just because we're seeing these symptoms and their cat has been diagnosed with hyperthyroidism, we do want to make sure there's not something else going on. We do want our kitties that we're going to be treating with radioactive iodine to be as stable as possible for treatment, just because they are going to be radioactive. So from a staff standpoint, we try to have fairly minimal contact with them just for our own safety. So if we send a cat in there who's diabetic and we don't realize and they become DKA while they're radioactive, it puts us in a really tight situation because we can't necessarily give that cat, the level of treatment we would like. We can't move it out of the treatment ward into the ICU around all of the other patients just because they are radioactive. So we do pretty thorough screening on these cats to make sure that they don't have any kind of concurrent disease going on. Or if they do have concurrent disease going on, we get that disease to a stable and manageable point before admitting these cats for treatment. Just so, to the best of our ability, nothing takes an unexpected turn while they're hospitalized with us. That being said, things do sometimes happen, so we do keep emergency supplies in the ward. I have only had to reach for an emergency situation once since I have been in the I-131 ward, which is great. It was a cat that had a seizure. We're still not sure why it had a seizure. It had never had one before, has never had one since. But she
Oh,
went
wow.
home the next day because she was this close to being at a level where she could be discharged. And we just called and followed up, and she's doing great now. So just a weird one-off. But anyway, that's my soapbox on making sure you do a thorough workup on these cats. A lot of times we find other things going on. And so when we're diagnosing these cats with hyperthyroidism, a lot of the time we're looking at T4 testing, which is the most common way these cats are diagnosed. There is also some other testing you can do for these cats before admitting them for I-131. If you have a cat that's like, in that kind of gray zone, the high threes, low fours with their total T4, but they're super symptomatic, there is something you can do called a T3 suppression test. Which, full
Oh
disclosure,
yeah, yep.
I have never personally done it in my career, and I'm pretty
Think
sure
I've
if I
only done it once.
yeah, I'm pretty sure if I suggest it to the doctor that I work with, she would laugh at my face. Just because it is a bit of a pain in the butt test to do. You have to draw serum beforehand, and then you basically administer oral T3 hormone every 8 hours for 2 days. And then on the morning of the third day, you give the last dose. And then 4 hours after that, you draw your post-test serum sample. So everything has to line up really well.
Yeah.
And owners don't want to hospitalize their cats for you to just be giving them meds every
Right.
8 hours for a test. And they're not going to want to do it at home. So I'm sure there is a good time and place for this test. So I think it's a good thing for people to know about if you do have to reach for it. But just from a practical standpoint, our T4s, our free T4s by EDs are great tests. And specifically when we're talking about radioactive iodine, gold standard testing is a scintigraphy test, so a thyroid scintigraphy. And what that test is you take a radioactive isotope. And you give it pretty much the way you would give any kind of contrast medium for a diagnostic image. It's much like giving Omnipaque for a CT scan. And that goes into the cat's bloodstream. And then you put the cat over a gamma camera, a gamma wave camera, which picks up the radiation in the cat's bloodstream. It's a very minimally invasive test, and it's pretty easy to do, but it's very expensive equipment. So not a lot of places have it. But what this test looks for is the isotope take up in the thyroid glands, so the two lobes on either side of the trachea on the neck and in the salivary glands. And when you have a cat that's euthyroid, so our thyroid is normal, that ratio of uptake between the salivary glands and the thyroid glands should be 1:1. So it should be nice and even. Everything should look the same. When you have a hyperthyroid,
I've seen photos of this and like in textbooks, and it's like so cool looking. Like, I mean, like it's a typical like contrast thing, but like it's just still like you're like, yep, there they are, really big.
I always feel like it looks like something you would see on Unsolved Mysteries when they're talking about alien abduction, like that fuzzy kind of outline with just glowing spots. But when you have a hyperthyroid cat, those two spots on the thyroid are going to light up pretty yellow and red. And this is a really nice test to do, not only if you're going to be doing I-131, but if you're going to be doing a thyroidectomy, because it does also locate ectopic thyroid tissue in the body. So that's just thyroid tissue that pops up anywhere other than the normal thyroid gland. That's a nice thing to know if you're going to be doing surgery, because it would be a big old shame to go in and remove that thyroid and have some ectopic tissue somewhere else and still have a symptomatic patient after all of that work.
And honestly, I mean, the ectopic tissue, that is a significant issue because it's like you've got extra tissue producing hormones. So, yeah.
We don't have the ability to do the scintigraphy where I work, but I would be very interested to see that test done. Like, I just from a learning standpoint, I think that would be such a cool test to see. And you can actually get the dose of isotope that you need to treat hyperthyroidism based on your scintigraphy. There's a formula you can follow based on like the amount of uptake you get.
Oh, wow.
However, where I work, we just use a dosing chart where if their thyroid is between certain ranges, we use a certain amount of isotope. Cats that are between like 4 to 7 with their thyroid, we typically dose pretty low, 2 to 3 millicuries. Our average dose is about 4 millicuries for our cats that have a thyroid of about 8 to 15. 5 is typically the highest we use. We do that for anything over 16 for our thyroid value. Very rarely, if we have a cat who we're retreating and their T4 has been, over 20, we treat it the first time, it doesn't fully resolve, we might go up to 6 or 7 millicuries, but that's typically the highest we'll do. But I guess I'm getting a little ahead of myself. I should really talk about what the, sorry, I get so excited.
Cool. Story of our lives.
I should really talk about what I-131 is first. So I-131 is a radioactive isotope. And to know what an isotope is, we do just need to review a little bit of everybody's favorite topic, chemistry. So we just need to really understand kind of the anatomy of our atom to understand what an isotope is. So at the center of our atom, we have our nucleus, and our nucleus contains our protons and our neutrons. Protons are positively charged little particles in the nucleus, and our neutrons are in there as well. We just need to understand the anatomy of our atom to understand what an isotope is. So, at the center of an atom, we have our nucleus, which contains our protons, which are positively charged particles, and our neutrons, which have no charge but do contribute to the mass of our atom, which will be important when we're talking about isotopes. And then around the outside of our atom, like little moons zipping around a planet, we have our electrons, which are negative charge. And when we're talking about an isotope, so an isotope is an atom that is the same core element. So in this case, it's still iodine, but it has a different number of protons. So it has a different number of neutrons. So it has a different atomic mass. This makes the isotope unstable. And much like with everything in nature, it wants to get back to being something stable. It all comes back to homeostasis in the end. So occasionally, the atom will try to change those protons into some kind of different type of particle to make itself more stable. And when that happens, we have energy released from the atom, and that's radiation. There are three main types of radiation we can get alpha decay, beta decay, and gamma waves. I won't go into how each of those happen because that is like a whole different ball game.
It's like above our pay grade.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We can ask our doctors about that, see what they say. But for the purpose of I-131, the forms of decay we see with that isotope is beta decay and gamma waves. So those are the two main types of radiation we're concerned with when it comes to I-131. And the way we get our name, I-131, is for iodine-131, because it has 131 protons in the nucleus, and it's trying to get back to just being regular iodine with 53 protons in the nucleus.
Oh, wow. That's a big difference.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. And I don't know if that has an effect on the level of like reactivity and volatility of it. Honestly, radiation and studying radiation decay is like a really intense thing.
Yeah.
But that is something I do keep researching just because my brain really wants to understand it. So I'll let you know if I ever find that out. So when we're talking about our I-131, it is an unstable isotope. It decays, like I said, with the beta and the gamma decay. It is excreted primarily through the saliva, urine, and feces of animals, and it has a half-life of 8.06 days, which will be important to know a little bit later. Of course, the half-life is the amount of time it takes for the quantity of the isotope to go to half of its original value. That's the number I know we talk about a lot with a lot of different pharmacology and medications. And now we get to the dosing that I was talking about earlier, right? So now that we understand what I-131 is, if we have our hyperthyroid patient that we've worked up, we can decide how much isotope we're going to give them. We use a compounding pharmacy called Pharmalogix. I don't know if I'm allowed to say what company we use.
Yeah. I mean, they're not a sponsor, so we don't have to worry about it, but they probably appreciate the shout out.
Yes, Kevin and Jack at Pharmalogix are who I call every week when we need isotope. They're great guys. Nice. And I just tell them how many millicuries we need for each cat we have coming in, and they compound that into a 1 milliliter injection. We give ours sub-Q. Yep. And I-131 is really cool because you can give it a couple different ways. You can give it subcutaneously, which is what we do. You can give it orally, or you can give it IV. A lot of the time, it's just one technician treating each week. We do our cats kind of in batches. So when we just have one person in there, it's typically easiest to just do a subcutaneous injection. And it's a really cool medication because the thyroid is the only gland in the body that uses it. So you don't really have to worry about systemic side effects. It makes it a very safe medication. And we don't see the same kinds of things that we do with methimazole reactions. And methimazole reactions are surprisingly common. I would say a pretty good portion of the cats that we see for I-131 are there because they've had some kind of methimazole reaction. Methimazole reactions can look like anything from facial pruritus and hair loss to bone marrow suppression. So we can see a decrease in our white blood cells, our platelets. They can become pretty anemic. A lot of cats will get vomiting and diarrhea with methimazole as well. So if you see those symptoms and you have a cat that's on methimazole, it might be worth talking about I-131 with your client. We also do a lot of I-131 for cats that won't eat their YD food.
Mm-hmm.
For anyone not familiar with YD, it's an iodine limited diet. It is the, as far as I know at the time of this recording, the only commercially available prescription diet for hyperthyroidism.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, I do think it's a great food in certain situations, but a lot of people have a really hard time with it because they have to be really strictly compliant with the YD.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of cats will develop taste aversions to it. It goes on back order. And, you know.
Well, and if you have like a multi-cat household, you can't use it. Like there's,
Yeah.
It's and a bummer for.
Especially like the food aversion, man. Anything. Like, because there's no replacement. There's no like, try this instead.
Right.
If they don't eat that, you're kind of done for with the food diet.
Yeah.
So that's another reason I-131 is kind of the gold standard. for treatment just because we tend to not see the side effects. We don't have to worry too much about food. Technically, they do recommend that you discontinue fish-containing products 5 to 7 days before your cat comes in for I-131 therapy. However, there have been some recent studies that suggest that the amount of iodine in fish-containing cat foods is so minuscule, you don't need to worry too much about it. However, that being said, this is a pretty expensive treatment. It is definitely an investment for clients. So we still recommend that they discontinue it just because we want patients to have every chance for success with this treatment. So with our I-131, it's curative in about 95% of cats with a single treatment. 3% of cats at our hospital in the past several years have had to be retreated with a second dose and have responded completely to that. We've had a 2% treatment rate of cats that have been completely resistant. So those cats do need to be managed on methimazole, YD, or have a thyroidectomy if medication or the food isn't an option for them. And then sometimes we go the other way. 1% of cats respond a little too well and become hypothyroid, but we don't usually worry about that too much unless the cats are symptomatic for it. And if they are, we just treat them with thyroxine. We just make sure we go over those statistics with owners pretty carefully before they, sign the paperwork to get their cat treated. Just so they know all of the risk factors so they can make an informed decision. Because if you're treating your cat because you can't medicate them, and then we do make them hypothyroid and they need thyroxine and they can't, they're kind of back to square one with that. Luckily, it is pretty rare. I've only seen it in one or two cats that we've treated. So owners are pretty willing to at least give I-131 a go. Because hyperthyroidism can be such a crappy disease for cats to have. It makes them feel so sick. And it's pretty amazing to see how quickly they feel better with I-131 treatments. They really bounce back within about 30 to 60 days post-treatment. It can take up to 90 days to see the full effects from I-131, have our thyroid going back to a completely normal range. But when they do, man, they're like new cats. They gain weight, their hair coat gets better.
Their eyes
They
look
just
normal
look like,
again,
yeah, they don't look as sunken
like
in. They don't have like that triangle face. So
They
after we, sorry, go ahead.
lose their smoker voice.
It's
Sometimes.
true, they do sometimes sound different. It's crazy.
Yeah. My cat did not lose his smoker voice. So at 3 a.m., we still hear him singing the songs of his people, but that's okay. We love him anyway. So after the cats are treated, we start doing 24 hours post-treatment. We'll start doing their post-treatment radiation measurements. And it's a pretty simple measurement. We literally just hold a Geiger counter up to them. And they're kind of like the old school Geiger counters that you would see in a Godzilla movie with like the
I love
wand
it.
and the block that you hold and it moves around and it makes the beeping noise. And really, how long they have to stay with us depends on your state regulations and guidelines. Where I am in the state of Maine, they have to be with us until they reach a radiation measurement of 1.8 millirems per hour, which, depending on the amount of isotope they got, is anywhere from about 72 hours to about 5 or 6 days. I've never had a cat take longer than about a week to get down to a 1.8 millirem per hour. I know some states, I think specifically in Virginia, I looked into their guidelines just because they popped up. They have to be at 0.5 millirems per hour. So it can vary pretty widely state to state, just depending on what the guidelines are. So
Yeah, I
that's
can't
just
remember
something
what
that.
California was, but I do remember we would warn clients that they'd probably have to be at the hospital for about 2 weeks. So I'm sure it's probably lower because it's California and that's what
Yeah, and
they
maybe up here we're pretty wild. We're pretty much like, oh, radiation, that's fine, shut
That's
them
fine.
out.
Just go out in the wild. It's fine.
And a lot of owners do get a little nervous about taking home a cat that's potentially still radioactive, but it's important to kind of just make sure these owners understand that, they're not bringing home a Chernobyl cat. What we worry about is human exposure to small doses of radiation multiple times over the human's lifetime. So we'll get owners asking if they need to keep their cats completely separate from the other cats in the household. Ideally, yes, just while the cat settles back in, and you can do a slow introduction. So that's more from a stress management standpoint. But we don't worry too much about it from a radiation standpoint, just because unfortunately our kitty friends don't live the same amount of time humans do. So they don't have those same cumulative effects from small doses of radiation throughout their life that humans can. So we monitor the radiation levels in the cats until they're down to, in the state of Maine, 1.8 millirems per hour. And then they are what my doctor likes to call street legal and can be released. So at that point, we're happy to send them home. Or if there's an owner at home who's immunocompromised, there's, a young child at home, someone who's pregnant or nursing, we do keep the cat for 2 weeks after they've reached that street legal value, just because we don't want this radiation to have effects on anyone who's immunocompromised or anyone with rapidly dividing cells, which is basically a fetus and a small child. Because there can be DNA changes even with small doses of radiation. Again, the likelihood that that would happen is very small, but we just want everybody to be as safe as possible. Also, we bond with these cats, so whenever we get to keep them for a little while longer, that makes us very happy as cat dads. Yeah, and once they go home, there are some what's the word I'm looking for? Some rules the owner has to adhere to. Because the cats are still letting off low levels of radiation when they're going home. And like we talked about earlier, the radiation is excreted through the urine and the feces and the saliva. So we don't want people cuddling in bed with their cats overnight and having prolonged exposure to radiation. We do recommend the cats be in a separate room at night. We do recommend that if you're petting your cat in this 2 week post-treatment window, you wash your hands really well, just because we know cats like to groom themselves and get that saliva all over their body. And again, it's all about minimizing the amount of radiation you're exposed to. So washing any traces of that saliva and radiation off your hands. We do have clients scoop their litter boxes twice daily. And what they do with that litter kind of depends on what their septic system is like. In the state of Maine, anyway, this might be different in other states, again, depending on guidelines. But in the state of Maine, you're on a private septic system. You do have to hold the litter for 80 days. So that's 10 times the half-life of our isotope. And that's when we've pretty much let all of that radiation decay and it's no longer radioactive. So what we have owners do is we have them go out and get like a big Rubbermaid tote and we have them line it with a trash bag. And then we have them get like a roll of like dog poop bags that you would like carry on your like dog leash. I don't know, I'm not really a dog person. I'm sure you guys know what
Yep.
that And then you scoop your litter box twice daily into that dog waste bag. You tie it up and you put it in your tote that has another trash bag in it so that the waste is double bagged. And at the end of the 80-day period, you pour the rest of the, or I'm sorry, the rest of that 2 week post-treatment quarantine period. You take the rest of the litter from your box, pour that into a trash bag and put it in that tote. You can either bag up your litter box and litter scoop as well and put them aside, or you can scrub them really well with like Dawn dish soap and water. Soap will help to inactivate the radiation that's clinging on to the waste. We just recommend people do it really, really well. And obviously, we're going to have people wear gloves when they're scooping the litter boxes, wash their hands really well. I would hope they're washing their hands after scooping boxes anyway, just from a
Meh.
basic hygiene standpoint.
I barehand it. I don't even use a scooper. Just kidding. Jordan's like, nope.
And then that tote gets sealed up and set aside for 80 days. You just want to make sure it's somewhere where it's going to be really out of the way. We don't want like kids finding it, digging through it. We don't want raccoons going through it.
Man, if that were me, like I know exactly what would happen. It would go somewhere in my shed or my garage, and then I would 100% forget about it. And then whenever I moved, I'd be like, "What is this?" And then like, who knows, like how old of a tote of litter I'd have. Like,
Oh my
just
God, that's awesome.
I 100% would forget
And you're
about it.
saying, you said that it's just the 2 weeks post, right? It's
Yeah. So
not
you're
80 days worth of litter, because
no.
that would
No, it's
suck.
2 weeks post, and then you're holding that 2 weeks of litter for 80
For the 80
days
days.
from when the cat is
Got it.
released. And we do send the dates home with the owners.
Oh, nice. Always good to have that client education.
Yes. When I'm doing their discharges, I'm not really good at counting the days out, so I usually just ask Alexa what the date is 80 days from the date the cat is going home, and I tell the owners to set a reminder on their phone from that date so it doesn't end up getting left for the next owner in the corner of the basement when the original owner was out of the house.
Jordan.
Yeah, that, like, because I'm already thinking, like, just planning to move now. I've already been telling the kids, I'm like, all right, let's start throwing stuff away, but like, I've already found like three boxes and I'm like, we haven't touched this since we moved into this house. So
Oh,
like,
I have those boxes too.
yeah, I have lots of those boxes.
Yeah, so that's pretty much all they have to do from a litter standpoint. They can go back to foods containing fish once they're home from treatment. Honestly, if we have a really picky cat in the ward and they're not wanting to eat, and we know they were on a fish-based diet prior to treatment, we may start offering that to them a few days after they get their isotope injection. Just because if, you know, your patient's not eating, that's setting them up for failure. You can have other things come up from that. So we like to keep everybody eating happy and healthy. The other big things that owners need to know is if their cat needs to be seen by a veterinarian 2 weeks post, in that 2 week post-treatment window, we ask that they call us and let us know so we can call their veterinarian and, you know, just go over some safe handling guidelines. We want to make sure that we're wearing gloves when we're working with these post-treatment kitties. And then we have them bring us any sharps that they use on the cat. We have them bag it up and we have like a little lead lined sharps container in the treatment ward room. And we just kind of label the date that cat's 80 days post-treatment date is, and we keep the sharps in there until then, and then we can toss them with the regular sharps. We do really stress to people to please not throw away their litter at the dump early because there are radiation detectors at the landfill centers that will go off if you send hot cat litter. Thankfully, it hasn't happened to us yet, but I really don't want to find out what happens if someone does do that and the landfill detectors go off.
My gosh, I could just imagine it's like, bah, 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 and they're like, whose cat poop is this?
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
And then if you're on a, you know, like a city sewer system, it's much easier. You can use a clumping litter and you can just scoop your litter box twice a day and flush it right down your toilet. The waste gets treated, so you don't have to worry about that. We're actually in the process of getting a new building for my hospital. And one of the biggest things that I-131 techs have been pushing for is a toilet in the treatment ward because we will be on public sewer so we can flush things down the toilet. Because let me tell you, the shed that we have right now that we have to keep all of the radioactive waste in is the thing of horrors. There's spiders because it's just a big cement building with a bunch of trash bins with cat
Cat poop
poop
and
in it.
pee.
So,
Yeah.
yeah.
Man, could you imagine how disappointed you'd be if you were like a thief and you broke into that building and you were just like,
You're like,
yeah.
this building's gotta have something super special in it. And you're like,
Yeah, like not only did you just open a bag of just cat poop,
poop.
but now you've also been exposed to radiation. Like, that'd be karma at its finest.
Oh, really? We do have that building marked with like radioactive material stickers. That's another thing we have to do. We have to keep our ward pretty clearly labeled with radioactive material stickers and signage, just from an OSHA standpoint. They're a little bit different than like the radioactive area signage that you see outside of like a radiology suite or something like that. But it's the same idea, just letting people know that they're around radiation. Then protection from a staff standpoint, if you
I
guys
was just
were
gonna say, like, do you get to wear like the whole suit?
So pretty much, it's pretty much just full like chemo treatment garb. We wear like a disposable chemo gown, we double glove, we have our safety glasses, we have our N95 masks, hair nets, just because, radiation can stick around in dust. So we do try to use a low dust litter, but you're never going to find a completely 100% dust-free litter, right? So we just try to cover up as much as possible to prevent any kind of contamination coming out. We wear shoe covers. And we measure ourselves for radiation too. So before we leave, we measure our thyroids, which is like deep penetrating radiation measurement, and our thighs, which is more shallow penetrating radiation. So your gamma wave radiation is going to be your deep penetrating radiation, and your beta radiation is going to be your shallow. We do also have two dosimetry badges that we wear that measure both the deep and the shallow penetrating radiation. So we measure ourselves to make sure we're not contaminated and taking radiation out of the ward. We measure our hands on the wand to make sure we don't have any hand contamination. And we do have action levels posted in the ward where if we're ever getting a radiation measurement of, for our beta radiation greater than 500 counts per minute, or our gamma radiation greater than about 3.0 millirems per hour, we reach out to our radiation safety officer, who's our doctor who runs the I-131 program.
So are those the like the OSHA numbers, work exposure? Like, you know how like radiation, like radiology has their numbers? So those are like the numbers for I-131 then.
So those
Okay.
are, they're very similar. We're still allowed to be exposed to the same amount of radiation that like your radiology workers are going to be. I think it's like something ridiculous. It's like 5,000
Yeah, I think if
millirems or
I
something like that.
remember when I kind of did radiology, I think it was 5 millirems per quarter was like the legal or something for like worker safety.
And
So.
I should know those numbers off the top of my head, but I apologize that I don't. We have them posted outside of our ward, and I see them every single day.
Right? You're like, oh, that sign that I have looked at a million times. Yeah.
But yeah, so I don't think we've ever had a big issue with our action levels, except for our syringe capper that we use for holding our radioactive iodine injections while we're getting the cat ready. Somebody once had the amazing idea to wipe test that, which is part of kind of our normal monitoring that we do. We'll take little Q-tips and we'll wipe everything down and put them into the Geiger counter and make sure nothing's too hot. And we had never done the syringe holder before, which is, where a lot of this isotope is hanging out, and it came back pretty hot. So that I think is still hanging out in our decay shed. We got a new one.
You're
So
like, that's fine.
it was fine. It wasn't a big deal. No, we just alerted our radiation safety officer and got it out of the building. Like I said, it's relatively small doses of radiation. It's just multiple repeated exposure over time.
Yeah.
And I think that's pretty much everything that I can think of right off the top of my head at the moment.
That was a lot of I-131 stuff. It was great.
Yeah, I just think it's really interesting. Like we've had a couple of patients that we recommended for it, and then I don't know. It's interesting because I think so many of the clients have like the stigma attached to it that they're like it's a radiation, and you're like, yes, but it's not what you're thinking of. It's
Well,
not
I
like the
think,
radiation you see in the movies where they become zombies or something. Like,
right.
it's very controlled, it's very specific. And I know if I remember correctly, like the reason why scintigraphy is such a good idea is if you've got ectopic thyroid, the I-131 is going to treat that too, versus like if it's surgery, then they may not find the ectopic thyroid, which is pretty cool. Like, I don't know, I just think it's really cool.
Yeah, it's great because it's like you're giving a treatment to an, how do I want to word this? It's like you're treating the cat's whole body for any potential hyperthyroid tissue, even if you don't know it's there. You're covering all your bases,
Yeah,
which,
yeah.
a thyroidectomy, I like the idea of it. The issue with it is if you don't get all of that overgrowth of thyroid tissue. If you just even leave a little bit behind, you're going to have regrowth, and then you run the risk of damaging the parathyroid hormones and causing all kinds of calcium imbalances.
Yeah.
And then you're in a whole different world of trouble there.
Yeah, and I think for us, like having conversations with clients about the benefits really of the I-131. Yes, it's expensive, but if you look at it like the difference between the one-time treatment, right, compared to daily medications, recheck lab works, all this, plus even if you control a hyperthyroid cat, not all of them really are controlled. Like they still have all these side effects from being hyperthyroid and everything. So it's, I mean, we had one cat that also was hyperthyroid and she had some heart disease, and she had the I-131, and like her heart disease like got way better. We didn't even say like go take care of your heart disease. But it just like was really cool that it also helped that, which is really, really awesome. But
Yeah,
yeah, it's
I
pretty
always
cool.
say that, hyperthyroidism and heart disease and kidney disease is the messiest of the love triangles. You're never going to find a love triangle worse than that one, because we do get, this increase in our metabolism. So we do get this increase in blood flow through our heart and through our kidneys, and it causes all of this damage that you unfortunately don't even really know is there unless you go looking for it. And I-131 takes care of a lot of that.
It's funny that you talked about hypothyroid. My coworker's cat ended up being hypothyroid. And I'm like, of course. I was like, it's because you work in this department. I was like, if you were just a regular client, that wouldn't have happened. So it was pretty
Yep.
funny though.
Nope. I think the one cat that I can think of off of the top of my head who became hypothyroid was a client cat, but luckily it was a really easy cat to medicate. It just had a methimazole reaction, so they're doing
Oh,
great on their
okay.
thyroxine.
I've seen some methimazole reactions that were pretty intense. And so we were like, nope. Like, you just need to do the one I-131. And it was funny because like I don't really know of any clients who regretted doing the I-131 when they did it. I have had clients regret not doing it sooner. They're like, no, it was just like a last resort. And they're like, man, I wish I would have done it sooner. 'Cause like, it's just, you don't have to medicate them then,
Yeah,
and they
well,
can have
funny
like
for you.
happy lives with it. So it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool
Yeah,
stuff.
medicating cats isn't fun. I'm a fear-free certified and low stress handling certified, and I'm very good with cats, and I hate medicating cats. Unless you really put like the time
The
into doing some
time.
proactive care training with them, which not, your average owner isn't going to understand that that's something they can do, right? So it's a lot less stressful for the cat because the owner's not chasing them around with the pill. It's a lot less stressful for the owner because they're not chasing their cat around with the pill. And you kind of preserve that human animal bond. It just makes everything go so much smoother.
Very cool.
Thank you so much, Kelly, for joining us and educating everybody on I-131 and how beneficial it is for our hyperthyroid cats that, really could use a little additional assistance on their thyroid front.
And we'll try to get some resources for everybody too, because I feel like even if we're not working with I-131, like it's good to understand it so we can recommend it to clients. I think that's
Well, that and
really
as a
important.
from a professional standpoint, because referral out to like these places is so big, it is, important for other technicians or assistants to understand like how to handle these cats if they do come back in contact with them after. So
Oh, for sure.
it's super important. So definitely share your resources with me, Kelly, so I can share it with everybody who listens. And then I'll try to get you back on here because I think we could. It sounds like you have a extreme passion for the felines and some endocrine
I
diseases. So,
sure do. Yes, I do. I mean, Yes, that is an understatement. Yes, I love the cats. Thank you guys having me so much. I feel a little too rambly. I get a little over-passionate about it sometimes, but I can't stop myself.
Nah, you're good.
You're our people, Kelly. No worries. Well, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you so much, everybody, for listening and making a commitment to learning. We hope everybody has a wonderful week, and we will chat with you guys next week. Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Internal Medicine for Vet Techs podcast. If you like what you heard, we'd love for you to share with someone you think might enjoy the podcast, and make sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Want to give us a boost? Please leave a review on iTunes or your favorite podcatcher, and we'll be sure to say thank you. Find out everything about us at internalmedicineforvettechs.com. Talk to you next week. Bye.